NATO says that it's planning to increase its
presence. NATO
は29日、加盟各国と。
Su intención de formar parte de la Alianza Atlántica.
Ukraine comme nouveau membre de l'OTAN.
NATO のラスムセン事務総長は。
Es gab bereits Berichte dahingehend, dass.
Der generelle NATO mówi wprost, Rosja jest za.
Ahead of the alliance's summit in Wales later this week.
Oh, what a difference 6 years and two wars make. When NATO heads of state gathered in Bucharest in 2008, Vladimir Putin stole the show. In the face of staunch opposition and heavy lobbying from Moscow, the Atlantic Alliance decided not to give membership action plans to Georgia and Ukraine, and the Kremlin leader left the summit triumphant. Months later, Russia invaded Georgia. And last month, Russia effectively invaded Ukraine. NATO heads of state are meeting in Wales this week, and this time, Putin is pointedly not invited. Membership plans for Georgia and Ukraine aren't on the agenda, but the subject of expansion is on everybody's mind. And the alliance, for the first time since the end of the Cold War, is making plans to beef up its military presence in the East and is viewing Russia not as a partner, but as a threat. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to a special edition of the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is Mark Galeotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome back, Mark. I hope you're getting settled back in New York.
Getting there. Good to be back.
Good to have you back. Well, as you look at the news this week, and as I prepare to depart for the NATO summit early tomorrow morning, NATO is planning military bases military facilities, I guess we'll call them, in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and Romania, according to media reports. Alliance officials talk about challenging and countering the hybrid nonlinear wars like the one Russia is now waging in Ukraine. Ukraine is considering abandoning its neutrality and potentially formally applying for NATO membership in the future. For decades, NATO has pretended that Russia was a partner, not an adversary of the West. But now it seems the mask is off. Mark, what do you see happening in Wales and going forward? How do you see this playing out down the road?
I think there are three basic points to make. I mean, I think it's the first one, actually, just a contextual one. I mean, obviously, we're focusing on Ukraine and Russia because we're Ukraine and Russia wonks. But I mean, we also have to realize that the NATO agenda also includes, you know, thorny issues relating to Afghanistan, what, if anything, can be done against the Islamic State, issues in, well, elsewhere in the Middle East, Libya and such like. So, I mean, I think we have to realize that this is not purely a Ukraine and Russia summit. But insofar as it is, the main thrust is clearly towards actually in some ways restoring the edifice that has been allowed to get rather ramshackle and crumbling in places. So we're talking about, you know, new pressure to make sure that all members spend at least 2% of GDP, which is sort of meant to be the kind of NATO benchmark, but only four countries in NATO actually spend that. And we have countries like, I mean, although Lithuania has promised now to do that, I mean, historically it's spent 0.8% of its GDP, and yet it's there on the borderland. Canada, 1%. I suppose they don't feel quite so much a threat. So anyway, so making sure that actually there is a much stronger military strength. As you've said, shifting, you know, the focus of the center of gravity eastwards, because these facilities in Central Europe, it's not so much that they dramatically change capacities of NATO. It's more that they are both symbolic and they become, as it were, tripwires. Then we'll see the NATO response force being beefed up, the idea that there's a sort of a 5,000 or so strong brigade level force that could sort of deploy within hours in case of a real crisis, and perhaps a command and control center in Szczecin in Poland. But these are all essentially military responses to a threat that is unlikely to be a direct military threat, unless something very, very sort of dramatic changed. But obviously that's what NATO does. It's a military alliance, and therefore it rightly thinks in military terms. And so the third key point is precisely that they are talking much more about how NATO can respond to the kind of blended political, military, business, intelligence-led operations that Russia has been waging and will probably be waging in the future. And here we come across the basic problem is that actually these are not necessarily things that NATO can do much about. It's all very well to wave the flag of Article 5, which means that a military attack on any member is a military attack on the whole alliance. But the point is that the Russians are aware of Article 5 too, and therefore will look to other ways of doing it. I know we're going to be talking more about these sort of these hybrid conflicts later in the podcast. But I mean, I think for me, that is the sort of the particularly thorny challenge. NATO is stepping up to the plate, if I can use unfamiliar sporting metaphors, in military terms, but against a threat that should not be considered essentially or even primarily in military terms.
Although NATO is returning to its core, I mean, in a sense, NATO, you said there's a lot of other things on the agenda here, but the thing that strikes me about this summit is it's the first time since the end of the Cold War that NATO is kind of returning to that core mission. And one has to wonder, do you think these facilities in the East, these facilities in the Baltic states, Poland, Romania, if that is what ends up being approved in Wales, will they have a deterrent effect? Will they be a tripwire? I mean, I know Rasmussen made comments to the effect of this earlier in the week where he was saying, well, if Russia tries something like they're trying in Ukraine in an alliance, in a member state, well, they're going to be meeting NATO troops there. So is that enough to deter, do you think?
Well, it's enough to deter certain things. I mean, as I said, I'm not in any way criticizing these moves. I mean, this is what a military alliance ought to be doing. And particularly if you look at somewhere like, I mean, Estonia is clearly one of the potential flashpoints because, you know, there is a Russian-speaking minority that, although actually has been, you know, really rather successfully integrated in the main, nonetheless, there are elements that Moscow could conceivably use as kind of political excuses in the future. So actually, you know, having a NATO base there says something. I mean, I think we have to realize the extent to which these are as much symbols of political will as much as actual sort of practical institutions. So yes, that makes sense. And in fact, not doing this, I think, would have been a very worrying sign. Mm. So absolutely, this does matter. If there had been NATO troops, I mean, inconceivable that would have been, in eastern Ukraine, then there's no way that Russia would have injected the level of military force that it did because of its terror of finding that they have a situation in which a Russian soldier pulls a trigger and kills a German or whoever. But it has value, but it only has a limited value.
No, I was visited Brussels earlier in the summer, visited NATO headquarters, and one of the questions I kept asking anybody I had the chance to ask, be they military or political officials, was what Russia was doing at the time and continues to do this nonlinear warfare, this use of proxies like they're doing in Ukraine. Say they did that in Estonia or Latvia, would that be an Article 5? Would that constitute an Article 5 violation? Would NATO be able to invoke Article 5 in that situation? And would NATO, in fact, invoke Article 5 in that situation? Because a lot of this does come down to Article 5. I mean, the strength of NATO is Article 5. And one of the fears that's out there is that, let's just say, Putin creates this kind of a situation in Estonia, for example, and NATO doesn't respond, doesn't consider it an Article 5 violation because technically tanks have not rolled across the Friendship Bridge, across the Narva River or wherever they may roll across. But in that sense, Article 5 would be dead and NATO would be dead. No?
Yeah. And in some ways, the parallel is if one thinks back to 2007 and the Estonian cyber attacks, which were, I mean, I really don't think I'm pushing my neck out when saying clearly inspired by and orchestrated by, if not necessarily carried out by, the Russian state, by Russian quote-unquote patriotic hackers and such like. However, both because NATO was unprepared to know quite what it could do in response, and secondly, because there was this issue of it's very hard to absolutely, definitively and objectively prove the initial source of a cyber attack, because it could be bouncing through all kinds of different servers and so forth. The response was, oh, this is terrible, but this is not an Article 5 issue. But I think we have to accept that, first of all, things have moved on since then. since then we've had Georgia. Since then we've had Ukraine. Since then we've had this much wider shift within Russian politics towards a more confrontational, neo-imperialist, millenarian almost sort of policy. So I mean, I think we, you know, we are in a very different world these days. Now, of course, you know, in those circumstances, if Russia did decide to try and put pressure on, and we're going to use, you know, continue to use Estonia as a case study, but it's not the only one we could think of. We could go to Romania and elsewhere. Then they clearly would be doing everything they possibly could to try and make sure that they didn't give NATO that nice, easy decision. So this is why it becomes a political question. I mean, on the one hand, a political question in the sense of how NATO decides, or where NATO decides to set the bar, how NATO chooses to define aggression and invasion in a world in which actually tanks rolling across the border is no longer the crucial point. And just a little sideline on that, by the way. I mean, this NATO response force is 13,000, of whom 5,000 would be immediately deployable. I mean, I think that says something about the new nature of war. Just as it's a few thousand Russian troops who have turned the tide of war in Ukraine, you know, the days in which actually 13,000 is basically the size of one Soviet motor rifle division.
Right.
Out of the, you know, the multitudes that would have been pouring through the Fulda Gap. You know, we're now in an age of small, high-tech wars. But there's the military response of what is an invasion.
So you think that's enough, yeah, as a military expert? You think that 13,000 is enough to do the job? Because a lot of people are kind of belittling this, like, oh, this is NATO's big response. They got 4,000 ready to deploy now, and they're going to get up to, 13,000. But as a military expert, you say that that is truly enough to do the job in the military sense.
Well, I mean, obviously, more is always better than fewer. But you have to think, I mean, what would these are not forces who would be, I don't know, fighting a counterattack all the way to Moscow. That is not what this is for. This is just to ensure that, let's say there is a situation like the Crimean situation again. One of the problems, or one of the things that allowed Russia to do what it was, is that Ukraine, the government in Kiev, was not only in complete disarray, but that it lacked the capacity quickly to deploy forces on the ground that actually would have made it a fight rather than just simply a neat little almost bloodless annexation. The point about these people is as soon as you see a potential problem, they're the guys who can be there on the ground. And if nothing else, are precisely saying, if you want to get past us, you will have to start shooting NATO soldiers.
Mm.
Then there's time, firstly, for the politicians to do their thing, the diplomats to talk, but also to mobilize the greater forces. For me, 4,000 or 5,000 troops is actually, you know, assuming they are, I mean, for me, the important thing is that they can move fast and that you have a command structure which can give them their orders quickly. In that context, 5,000 or 10,000 to me doesn't make a difference.
Right. Now, the other thing that and actually, I want to continue on this point just briefly. So you think if this something like this were as improbable as this is, but just hypothetically, if something like this were in place for Ukraine, the Crimea situation would have turned out much differently, not even to speak of the Donbass situation.
Yeah, I mean, in fairness, I doubt that necessarily it would have stopped Crimea, because I think the thing about the Crimea is not just simply a lack of available forces, is that, you know, people and, you know, everyone really didn't think that the Russians could do this and would do this with the same speed and efficiency as they did. I mean, in fairness, Russians tend to be very good at, as it were, the carefully planned operation and often also maintaining strategic surprise. And this very much was a archetypal case of Russia. I mean, the Russians then tend to fall down on detail afterwards, but that's sort of another matter. So, I mean, I think even if there had been these forces, there would not have been the immediate readiness to deploy them. In this respect, Crimea provides a very, very useful, informative, and quite scary case study of what Russia can do. So one would hope that in future, if, let's say, you know, Crimea too happened, some other convenient peninsula or island, you know, emerge, NATO would move more quickly, but now it would definitely have the forces with which it could move more quickly.
Now, moving quickly for NATO is, at the end of the day, a political decision, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, another one of the things that really struck me when I was in Brussels in June was when you talk to the NATO staff, the permanent staff, the people that work there, you know, every day, you know, 365 days a year, for them, the world had changed utterly and entirely. and that Russia was now an adversary. And this was across the board. It didn't matter where you know, which member state somebody was from, whether they were from some a member state that you would think of normally as being more accommodating to Russia or a member state that you think of being more confrontational. It didn't matter if it was a Pole or a German, for example, who I talked to. For the staff, the thing that had, everything had changed utterly. But everybody reminds me, and it reminded me, and I was well aware that NATO is a political organization. Decisions are taken by the heads of state of the NATO members. And what the other question that's lurking in my mind now is, does NATO have the political will to defend its members? What do you think? It's a different kind of, it's more of a political question than a military question, of course.
Yeah, I mean, and the honest answer is this is inevitably going to be something that will ebb and flow. At present, I don't doubt it for a moment.
Okay.
On the other hand, we could spool forward and assume that, let's say, either, Putin stops pushing, some kind of settlement is reached in Ukraine, he stops pushing, we have another couple of years in which actually Russia seems to be returning to a more partner-based mode. Hard that is to believe, but I think, Western democracies don't like conflicts. Someone will come forward and saying it's time for a reset and whatever else. And, I think then people's vigilance, people's sort of the priority of defense will inevitably, begin to ebb. And this is one of the reasons I think it's really important to actually have a clearer sense for NATO of quite what aggression, quite what a breach of Article 5 looks like in the modern world. Because it's a little bit like, it's a slightly fanciful parallel, but if you look at the way that stock markets have evolved, from being one in which actually people would sit down with their analytic reports and talk to others and make a decision as to what to buy and what to sell, to one in which actually increasingly things are actually being done by computers in sort of nanoseconds, based on complex algorithms of buy and sell. The world is getting too fast for old ways of handling things. Now, given that we're not going to be wanting to be a situation in which some computer at NATO headquarters decides on peace or war, thank God, instead, what we have to do is kind of accepting that is actually have essentially almost standing orders. These sorts of things are considered to be aggression, and under those circumstances, this is how NATO will respond without needing to have démarches, without needing to have heads of state gathering.
Yeah, no, this is something, and I remember years and years ago, I was interviewing James Jones, who at the time was the Supreme Allied Commander. And this is when the first talk of the Rapid Response Force was coming in, was being discussed very seriously. And one of the things that was on the table at the time was they were trying to get the deployment of the Rapid Reaction Force to be in the hands of the Supreme Allied Commander, which takes it out of the political arena. But this, of course, raises issues, right? Mm-hmm. Basically, you have one man deciding when NATO is going to deploy its forces. But when you say standing orders, is that moving toward that kind of a thing? Because at the end of the day, would it be the Supreme Allied Commander that makes the decision? Would General Breedlove be the man right now that would decide if there's going to be peace or war? Not a computer in Brussels, but and not 28 heads of state, but one general.
Yeah, I think we are probably heading towards that kind of a situation. But I think one has to note that before we head into full strangelove territory, I mean, I think that there is a big difference between, for example, saying that SACEUR can deploy this rapid reaction force anywhere within the areas of NATO with the agreement of the local government. Mm. So that, for example, if all of a sudden it looks as if there's going to be a crisis exploding in Estonia, and the Estonian government is happy to accept them, then the forces can be there. Mm-hmm. I don't think we could conceive of a situation in which, without political cover, he could actually order his forces into, say, Moldova.
Right, right. Into the territory of a non-member state.
Right.
One of the things, and this is all interlinked, but I was like looking at the news the last few days, being in Prague, I was paying a lot of attention to the Czech news, and the Czech prime minister came out, and this we're talking about EU matters here, but this bleeds into NATO matters in a lot of ways. The Czech prime minister said that the Czech Republic wasn't actually down with sanctions against Russia. And if the EU impose sanctions, the Czechs might seek to opt out, now which they can't do according to the EU. But this, when you have this kind of dissent from, let's face it, a country that's not historically been very pro-Russian in this situation. It makes me wonder if how much consensus you're going to be able to get in NATO. Are we in a new normal, or can this go back to business as usual? This is the larger question I guess I'm trying to drive at here.
I suppose that begs the slightly sort of tongue-in-cheek question, well, what was business as usual?
Business as usual was pretending that Russia could be housebroken, as I believe you or somebody put it on this podcast recently. The debate in the West about Russia has been broken down to people who believe that Russia is an adversary and it's going to be an adversary and you have to treat it like an adversary and be prepared to counter it, and those that think that if you're nice enough to Russia, they will become more housebroken and eventually mellow and change and be more amenable to the West. That debate seems to be off the table for the time being, although not entirely. Not entirely. When you have the Czech prime minister saying things like, we don't need to sanction Russia, we need to sit down and talk to them. Mm-hmm. Well, that makes me think, all right, I thought we were in a new normal, but maybe we're not.
I think what we are is precisely in a process of transition, as hopefully people work their way through and get a better sense of, first of all, the sort of the strengths and limitations of Western hard and soft power, but also quite what's going on in Russia. I mean, I think there's several different processes that are intertwined here. I mean, first of all, purely on the NATO sense, I think that because NATO has a certain purity of role, it is a military alliance, although this has slightly been blurred by recent forays into peacekeeping and peacemaking and such like, but essentially it is a military alliance to defend its member states against foreign threats, brackets, we all know that means Russia under whatever incarnation, close brackets. And that gives it a certain sort of capacity to hold a greater degree of unity, even if on issues like sort of how much do you spend, there's this massive variation. But on the other hand, that is not all that is needed in the modern conflict theatre. Actually, it's something that we've raised in previous podcasts. NATO cannot do the job if the EU is not doing its job. And that is, to a large extent, immunizing its countries through civil society, through inclusion, but also through creating sort of reasonable political consensuses about quite what the EU is about and what Russia is about, in order to ensure that there aren't these disenfranchised minorities or notionally disenfranchised minorities that can be used, or wedges that can be driven between the member states. This is precisely a political military conflict, and therefore it requires a political military response, or political military and economic response actually, and NATO can only do one part of that. So, I mean, I think for me there is a big concern, as you see, the disunity within EU members. And it's not just the Czech Republic. We've also seen a certain amount of flip-floppery with Italy, for example.
Hungary and Slovakia. I mean, one thing that another thing that grabbed my attention this week was Sergei Shoigu was making a visit to Slovakia. Right now, the idea of the Russian defense minister visiting a NATO and EU member state is a little bit odd. And the Poles apparently thought it was odd, too, because the Poles blocked their airspace and wouldn't let Shoigu fly over Polish airspace to get to Slovakia. But here you see, again, two Eastern European states, two parts of so-called New Europe, which was traditionally more suspicious of Russia, at odds over the visit of the Russian defense minister to one of their capitals. Go ahead. I wanted to let you finish your point.
I think just the final point, when you discussed that there was a sort of disagreement or alternative perspectives as to whether or not to be sort of nice and friendly towards Russia and hope that it just suddenly sort of begins to grow in the direction you'd like, or to treat Russia as a problem. My view is much of the difficulty that the West has had with formulating policy with Russia is precisely because it tends to sort of seesaw or find itself sort of caught between these two elements. My view is you have to blend the two. In the short term, when we're facing an essentially aggressive, pushy, insecure in many ways, but aggressively insecure Russia, then actually maintaining strong boundaries in every sense of the word is tremendously important. Actually saying, look, these are things that if you do, we are not willing to accept them and we will do something about it. But at the same time, actually, you know, moving towards a strategy of, for example, containment, long term, would be a dramatically foolish move. I've long felt that actually, you know, every foreign student exchange, every tourist trip that Russians carry on in the West actually contributes to the drip, drip, drip spread of values that we would find more comfortable. The point is, you can't, as it were, you know, again, if we want to use this admittedly slightly insulting, but since I think I originally used it, dog metaphor of house training, you know, you can't just use shouting at the dog or trying to reassure the dog. You actually have to balance. Mm-hmm. You have to make them feel secure, but within very, very sort of strong boundaries. Now, the trouble is that at the moment, Moscow, what it seems to think that it needs to feel secure are things that we're not willing to accept. I mean, for example, basically trying to ensure that Eurasia is its privileged sphere of interest. So obviously, in those circumstances, we have to rebuff Russia. We have to say no. You do not have special privileges, rights with Ukraine. Yeah, you have a, you know, disproportionate influence over Ukraine because Ukraine needs you. That's fine. But the point at which you start crossing the boundaries and thinking that means that you can steal and invade bits of this country are the points at which we say we have a problem.
Or decide what its government is in contradiction to the will of its electorate.
Quite. And, you know, and let's be blunt. I mean, one of the problems is this provides ample fodder for the whataboutists and Kremlin apologists is that, you know, in the past, the Western countries have often tried to do that in all kinds of places. And that's a problem. But that's a different problem to be solved on a different podcast.
Right. No, one of the things that, and we were talking about NATO getting back to its old mission, and its core mission is protecting the security of its member states. Since the end of the Cold War, that old mission has kind of been taken for granted. It's been taken for granted because in the 90s, Russia was too weak to be a threat. And Putin's Russia, we didn't think was actually going to follow through, despite its bluster, wasn't going to follow through. Now it is a threat. And NATO has a lot of holes to plug now. This goes back to your comments at the very beginning about kind of returning to the restoring the edifice of NATO. Where do you see, in addition to the defense spending issue, which is certainly going to be on the table in Wales, where do you see, what other holes do you see NATO needing to plug?
Well, see, perversely, I don't think that there are massive holes. I think, you know, raising general levels of spending and thus military preparedness across the board, ensuring that there are facilities and the capacity to deploy along the eastern border of NATO, which is exactly what's being done. I think that does the job as regards NATO. Mm. I think we come back to this point of actually the real holes to be plugged are not ones that NATO mm-hmm. can do anything about. NATO is not in the business of preventing Russian money from acquiring dangerous stakes in strategic industries right. in Central European countries, for example. NATO is not in the business of ensuring that political movements which might fragment Western cohesion flourish thanks to Russian support and money. All these other kinds of things. The real threats that we face are not primarily NATO threats. Now, of course, if NATO decayed anymore, then the capacity for Russia to mount different kinds of threats increases. But given that, I don't think that's going to happen. I think that there comes a point where we have to pivot and say, okay, NATO is fixing itself, and that's great, necessary, and good. But who steps up to address all these other non-traditional security threats?
Right, and that's and this I guess it's a prophylactic, is it's inoculating these societies against this kind of thing, and that what you would say falls to the EU.
Well, it falls to the EU simply because at the moment the EU is what's there, and the EU precisely has an explicit political and economic metal. Now, I mean, one could theoretically see some kind of alternative structure that went beyond the EU. A kind of non-kinetic NATO that also, for example, included North America and could conceivably include other countries. Because in a way, although bringing, say, Georgia and Ukraine into NATO is, I think, for the moment, not on the cards and would be deeply problematic, because then you would actually have, you know, joint exercises and, you know, American tanks in Georgia and whatever else.
The Georgians would welcome that.
The Georgians would welcome that. But I think I think there's a lot of diplomats who wouldn't. But on the other hand, actually, if one had some other structure that was explicitly, we don't have soldiers, we're about all kinds of other things, then it might actually be easier to incorporate Georgia, Ukraine, Moldova, you know, other potential countries that need that kind of support. But these are massive separate political issues that aren't going to be settled in Wales.
Well, one of the things that is going to come up in Wales is kind of the engagement with non-members in Sweden and Finland, for example, which are increasingly working closely with NATO. Mm. But if you're going to expand that to Sweden and Finland, well, hell, why not Georgia and Ukraine? Because these are the kinds of things you're talking about, the more political engagement, coordinating diplomatic activity and things like that. That could easily be expanded into, as you called it, a non-kinetic NATO. It'd be almost like a political arm of NATO. That why not bring Georgia and Ukraine into that? They wouldn't get an Article 5 guarantee, which is what they truly covet, but they'd get something.
Well, precisely. I mean, I think, you know, true NATO membership, one of the basic principles is that there should be no passengers. Now, okay, one could make a case for Liechtenstein with its 0.whatever% military expenditure. But basically speaking, NATO members, they have to have a certain level of interoperability of their forces with other NATO forces. You know, they have to be able to stand up on their own. NATO is not there in the main to just simply protect the vulnerable. It is a partnership. And at the moment, Georgia and Ukraine are nowhere near in the position that they actually are of NATO standards. But yes, one can find other ways of giving sub-Article 5, but nonetheless more robust than at present, guarantees, which, you know, in the past, the West has been very disinclined to do. And I say the West because it's, in a way, we have NATO and EU almost as two parallel but slightly separate institutions. But I think there comes a point where we have to decide whether or not what happens in Ukraine matters to us. Whether we simply feel, well, look, you know, we live in a nasty, brutish world where nasty, brutish things happen, and as long as they don't happen within our borders and as long as our interest, you know, the gas keeps flowing, that's fine. I think we have begun to reach the point where we're not willing to see this. And therefore, we have to think, well, okay, well, what are the means in which we can assert the boundaries of what we are willing to let happen? And I think, yes, some kind of institution, some kind of structures which provides a degree of protection for vulnerable countries, I think is really important.
I mean, it's amazing, though, that it wasn't that long ago that Georgian membership was on the table. I mean, in 2008 in Bucharest, it was an open question whether Georgia and Ukraine, which at the time had applied for NATO membership, they had since withdrawn their application. We didn't know. I covered that summit, and God, we didn't know if they were going to get membership action plans. And the irony now is that Georgia, according to several military analysts I've spoke to, has essentially already fulfilled all of the requirements that would have been in a theoretical membership action plan had they gotten it in 2008. Which meant that, in essence, if we were followed the roadmap from then to now, Georgia would be on track to be full member now.
Yeah, I mean, and this is what I mean about how the world has changed. I mean, there are certain questions about the sustainability of Georgia's military reform, but let's not get sort of too bogged down into the technicalities. But yeah, I mean, I think at that point, when in 2008, pre-Georgian war and so forth, NATO was considering this, it clearly put far too much emphasis on how will Russia respond. And there was the sense that it would poison relations irretrievably. And I mean, let's be honest, even now you have voices who are willing to say that basically, well, Russia did and is doing what it's doing in Ukraine because NATO didn't sort of treat it fairly.
Mm-hmm.
Nonsense, but nonetheless, you know, a pervasive nonsense that in some quarters actually has a certain amount of traction.
I would actually argue the opposite. I mean, months after that summit, when Russia essentially got everything it wanted, what did Russia do? It invaded Georgia.
Precisely. And I think this is what we've seen. We have actually seen that a grand strategy of conciliation, unsupported by toughness, has failed. The reset has failed. There is no question about that. Now, in that circumstance, one has to therefore create a situation, not one that sets out to, well, I mean, one could theoretically do this, but not one that sets out to target Russia as Russia, but instead sets up certain sort of international boundaries of behavior and says, if you cross those boundaries, you will be targeted. but not because we don't like Russians, but because we don't like people who invade and destabilizing neighboring countries, whoever they may happen to be.
All right. Well, on that note, we'll shift gears to the second half. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion of this week's NATO summit and broaden the aperture and look at the emerging conflict between Russia and the West. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Today, we must face the reality that Russia does not consider NATO a partner. We can see in Russian military documents, we can listen to statements from Russian political leaders that they consider NATO an adversary. I strongly regret that, because I do believe that the right thing for Euro-Atlantic security would be to develop a strong partnership with Russia. But of course, we cannot afford to be naive. We don't have any illusions. We are faced with the reality that Russia considers us an adversary, and we will adapt to that situation.
In all likelihood, there won't be a new Checkpoint Charlie. Tanks won't be facing off across a new Fulda Gap. It won't be your father's Cold War. After decades of globalization, an information revolution, and a Russia that is deeply integrated into the world economy, the looming conflict won't be your traditional military standoff. It will more likely resemble the nonlinear hybrid conflict we've been witnessing in Ukraine for the past 6 months. So what do you think, Mark? Are we headed for a nonlinear hybrid Cold War? And what would that look like? Because as we heard the NATO Secretary General speaking there at the beginning of this segment, we are headed for some kind of a conflict. Is it going to be a nonlinear hybrid Cold War? Can we put that many modifiers in front of it?
I mean, part of me wants to sort of flip that round and say, in a way, we're going to be heading for a hot peace, in the sense of, I don't think that we're going to be heading for a situation of direct conflict. I mean, I honestly don't think that, for example, we're going to see the Russians trying to move their tendrils into Estonia to destabilize it or anything like that, unless the West dramatically lets down its guard. Instead, I think we will be faced with a particularly uncomfortable, confrontational, yes, adversarial relationship with Russia, in which point it will be sort of pushing on every front. But as with the Cold War, I mean, actually holding back from the big one, holding back from a direct sort of confrontation. And they'll use all kinds of tactics. I mean, anyway, the old model of proxy wars was that you support the guerrillas or the government in some developing world country and the other side supports the others, whether it's Afghanistan or Nicaragua or whatever. Well, now, as it were, the proxy wars are more likely to be fought through, you know, supporting different political and even social forces. We'll see soft power being deployed, not so much for positive reasons, again, as in the Cold War, where it was a sort of, you know, liberal democratic model versus the socialist communist model. Instead, being deployed for negative purposes, to try and disrupt political consensus, to try and ensure that other countries can't really act properly. We will see business, both legal and illegal, facing sort of penetration and exploitation. So, I mean, in this respect, you know, what this new whatever it is going to look like is in many ways the old Soviet strategy of destabilization manipulation, but on steroids, wearing an Armani suit, but still packing a knuckle duster. Mm. You know, force will always be there as the backstop if enough, you know, the opportunities and the weaknesses apply.
Now, when you step back and look at this, and I was actually thinking about this yesterday, like what assets do you have? If you're Russia looking at this situation, what assets do you have? You basically have two things in this kind of a nonlinear hot piece, cold, or whatever you want to call it. Russia's got its energy resources and it's got its market, because these are the two things that are, I think, right now that are tempering a strong Western response. The West is afraid of losing the gas won't keep flowing, That's one big fear. And the other fear, and you see it in statements from everybody from the American Chamber of Commerce to German industrialists, people are afraid of losing access to that Russian market, which is big and lucrative.
Mm-hmm.
Right? How do you engage in a confrontation with an adversary that has these two assets? Well, on the energy, it's easy. You create the alternative supply. I mean, it's not easy, but it's very doable. Right? Mm-hmm. You get those LNG terminals built in Europe. You develop shale, you develop renewables, and sooner or later, the Russian energy weapon won't be as fearsome as it looks today. The market's another matter. Russia's market's going to be there. It's a big market. It's a very lucrative market, and Western firms do not want to lose access to that market, which is probably some of the logic behind the counter sanctions that Putin used. It's the other thing they have, their market, mm-hmm. that they can take away from us. How do you engage in a conflict with an adversary that has these tools at its disposal?
Well, in a way, the answer to that, I think, rests on also acknowledging that there is a third crucial advantage that Russia has, in my opinion, and that is certain Western vulnerabilities. We're facing a situation in which, yes, this is not a, you know, as you said, this is not your father's Cold War. No one really believes that Russian tanks are going to rumble through Europe. No one believes that there's going to be some attempt to impose Russian control over the West in that kind of crass territorial sense. There is a difficulty creating a political consensus in the West, and a difficulty that actually Russia is doing everything it possibly can to encourage. But perhaps most importantly of all, there is a marked reluctance to pay the price of conflict. You know, just as we've seen that actually, you know, in military terms, modern Western societies are very casualty of, you know, averse. You know, a handful of people being killed can change mm-hmm. Policy. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I think that's a fine thing. So, you know, no one wants to say that death is okay. But nonetheless, you know, compare that with days in which actually, you know, if you look at, you know, either of the world wars or even, you know, pre-World War I sort of territorial conflicts, actually, you know, 100 deaths, 1,000 deaths, well, as long as there's more people you can recruit, that's not a problem. Well, now we're facing a conflict in which actually the casualties are going to be economic and political. And we do see a very marked reluctance to pay the price, whether that's the French not giving Russia the first Mistral assault carrier that they had bought, which still seems to me a ludicrous thing that the French are still willing to give a military attack vessel to the Russians, or else they're saying, oh, but NATO should buy it instead. In other words, what they're saying is, we're happy to do the right thing as long as we don't actually have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And we see the same whether it's Britain and the City of London, whether we, you know, obviously the countries that rely on, you know, Russian hydrocarbons and such like, and just the political costs of feeling that you are locked into a conflict. That is in some ways the underlying strength Russia has. Russia is far more willing to, or no, correction, the Kremlin. Mm-hmm. I have to see what ordinary Russians feel. The Kremlin is far more willing to pay the price at the moment of this conflict because it feels that it's a price that it's going to be bearable and controllable for it. You talk about shale gas. You know, for a lot of people, actually what's happening in Ukraine is a long way away, that Russia is not a threat. And they're more concerned about, well, what is this going to do to our environment? What is this going to do to our countryside? Are we going to have earthquakes and such like? Now, you know, if you're in the middle of a real war, then if you need to bulldoze a priceless natural habitat to build an airbase, well, you bulldoze the habitat. But because we're not in that kind of situation, there are so many more variables. And given that, you know, Russia is essentially an authoritarian oligarchy, it can make decisions more quickly and more ruthlessly than the West can. And so I think that is why the energy and the market issues matter. It's because precisely we want to be able to maintain this competition, or conflict rather, with Russia. We want to be able to tame Russia, but we don't want to have to pay the price mm-hmm. in terms of access to energy, in terms of access to markets.
Do you see this conflict evolve, or this hot piece, or whatever we're going to call it, evolving to a point where Russia gets disentangled from the global economy. A couple of things, this one I read on Bloomberg News, one of the things that's being considered but is very unlikely to happen. But it's something that would cripple the Russian economy and be fairly easy to do, is taking them off the SWIFT system.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't be able to transfer money. They did this to Iran, and this is the one sanction the Iranians really, really, really care about. But it's not going to happen for a whole variety of reasons. Cutting off their credits. Well, the last report I saw about where the EU sanctions might be headed. Right now, Russia can't get credits any longer than 90 days. They're thinking of cutting that to 30 and expanding it not just to banks, but also to all Russian state firms, which is interesting. Mm. That would include Gazprom, presumably, right?
Mm.
Another thing that can be done that is not done right now is Gazprom can't extract its gas without Western technology. Statoil is providing a lot of the technology that Gazprom is using. You forbid stuff like that. But a lot of this is probably not going to happen. What is it going to take to, or can you even disentangle Russia from the global economy and from the Western economies?
Obviously, Mr. Putin would love, in many ways, to be able to disentangle Russia from that, and that
really?
Hence talk about. Well, I mean, you might say on his own terms, he would love to be able to do so. But the point is, look, no, you cannot disentangle Russia completely. I mean, unless Europe is willing to have a very, very cold winter.
Mm-hmm.
So that's fine. I mean, but the virtue of this situation, the virtue of this hot piece, is that precisely at present, we have allowed the Russians to play the asymmetries to their advantage. What we need to do is precisely play the asymmetries to our advantage. There are all kinds. You mentioned some very effective potential sanctions. I mean, I think, for example, for me, precisely technology transfer, which is also part of the Mistral story, is one of the sort of the particular areas. And we can also move into the sort of the wider issues. Of just making life uncomfortable for Russians who are, of a certain sort of elite-y status. Even just simply sort of just limiting visas and such like much more sort of aggressively. There is a lot that can be done. But again, just to sort of loop this conversation back to the first part of the podcast, nothing that you mentioned, nothing that I've mentioned, is within the purview of NATO.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at present, the interesting thing is that, as it were, NATO is the shield, but the sword, if I can use my good KGB iconography, is actually the EU or just wider Western alliances of states or just individual states doing things. And this is why we're in this sort of complex environment. But when it comes down to it, none of these options can be done without cost. None of these options will not have business interests squealing and rushing for their lobbyists, or see energy prices increase and therefore newspaper articles about pensioners going cold in the winter or whatever it is. We need to decide how important this conflict is. We need to decide how important it is to actually be able to maintain a really strong line with Russia, one that in the long term will be good for us and good for Russia, because it won't encourage the kind of adventurism that we're currently seeing dominant. But we need to pay the price for that.
Mm. Well, to bring this also all around full circle, you mentioned in the first half of the podcast that much of this is the EU's job and much of this is NATO's job. Imagine you were advising both on security. What steps would you advise NATO and the EU to take in order to head this kind of thing off in the future?
I mean, I think primarily NATO is doing what it needs to do. I mean, I think the one unspoken issue or unaddressed issue, which I'm sure will be addressed, is precisely what to do about new members or sort of potential kind of affiliate or protectorate members.
Mm-hmm.
It's the EU that has so much more to do. And the problem is, this is not probably a matter of just simply creating some new EU directorate. In fairness, the European Union functions best when it functions least. We're actually talking about far greater, consensus, but also cooperation between, for example, intelligence services in Europe. At the moment, it's still relatively difficult to, for example, carry out serious probes of where does this business come from? where does this money come from? And, you know, a lot of intelligence agencies have pieces of the jigsaw, and frankly, too rarely do they actually pool those pieces and get a sense of the real picture. So there are issues like that that have to be addressed within the context of the European Union, but not necessarily entirely by the European Union as an institution.
Now, if you look, it's interesting that you raise, because one of the things that set off this conflict with Ukraine was what? It was Ukraine being prepared to sign an association agreement with the European Union. As much as Mr. Putin wants to turn this into a global conflict, that's what this was about. Mm-hmm. And Putin, for whatever reasons, and we've gone into a lot of the reasons in previous podcasts, didn't want that to happen. That was an extension of the European Union's Eastern Partnership Program, which was designed to bring, to do all of the things that you said the EU should be doing, fostering civil societies, creating the inoculation against this kind of unrest. Did the EU just not follow through, or what was wrong there? Because that's precisely what the EU was doing.
Yeah, I think the EU, first of all, you know, wasn't fully aware of the consequences, because, you know, part of the agreement locked Ukraine out of Putin's Eurasian sort of
which is logical.
Zone.
You can't be in two customs unions at once.
Absolutely, but you know, but it was a fairly obvious flashpoint.
Right.
And then when it came down to it, I mean, you know, and in part the EU is paying for its past sins. You know, clearly Moscow did not and does not regard the EU as a serious institution. And, you know, when Moscow started to cause trouble, there was no real... I mean, you know, frankly, a trip from Baroness Ashton does not count as a major deployment of European Union political capacity. I don't think the EU followed through. I don't think the EU appreciated the extent to which, by extending this agreement to Ukraine, it was, in effect, taking on certain political responsibilities. Mm-hmm. It was expecting Ukraine to precisely turn its back on Moscow. And, you know, it's obvious that in some way or other, Moscow was going to respond. Now, I don't think, you know, we didn't expect the kind of response that there was. But again, I think it's important to stress the reason why Russia has Crimea, the reason why Russian forces are now in eastern Ukraine, is precisely because of the near collapse, frankly, of the Ukrainian state, both as a product of the sort of closing points of the Yanukovych regime and actually how that transition happened. So again, Russia will take opportunities. Russia will try and create opportunities. But on the other hand, you know, if Ukraine had been fully working, if the military chain of command had been such that actually the first sight of little green men appearing, that there would have been forces deploying from their bases with live ammunition, then I think it's questionable whether or not Russia would have pushed at all as far as it did.
Hmm. Okay, any final thoughts before we wrap it up for this special edition of the Power Vertical podcast?
I mean, I think the sort of question is going to be, well, you know, the big question for the NATO summit as regards Russia is how far it's tactical and how far it's strategic. How far it's going to be about, let's try and solve this problem in Ukraine, and how far it's let's try and solve the problem that is Russia. Because if it's the former, which is tempting because it's much more focused, and also, you know, it addresses a very real problem, then, in effect, Putin can do what Putin so often has, which is to make certain concessions, say, well, I'll keep Crimea, I'll, you know, as long as there's very, very robust guarantees for the, you know, the autonomous governance of the East, I'm willing to pull back my forces and such like, with a win, and yet be hailed as a peacemaker by those elements of the West that would like to put this behind them. If, on the other hand, as I suspect really ought to be the case, the question simply becomes, Russia as it is currently ruled is a challenge, is a problem. What do we do about it? That's a point where actually this NATO summit ought to be the start of a wider conversation about how we protect the West, and most importantly, the values which are enshrined within the institutions of the West. Sounds very pious, but right. It's true. So, you know, it's a question of whether, as it were, Wales is an end point or a start point, which for me is going to be crucial.
What's I mean, I'll get pious in the very last question remark. I'm getting the feeling this could be a historic summit. Do you get that feeling, too?
I don't know. I mean, this is the English chauvinist in me. Sort of historic, historic and Wales very rarely seem to get it. No, I'm joking apart, and I apologise to all the Welsh listeners to the podcast. No, joking apart, I mean, I think it's going to be historic, not because I think we're going to come, you know, not because something that truly world-changing is going to come out immediately. You know, the final statements, and yes, the almost inevitable sort of, you know, guarantees for Central Europe and moving facilities and so forth, in and of themselves, do not represent anything historic. I think what is historic about this summit is precisely that I do believe it marks a shift in the consensus. It's not universal, but I think there is a consensus, as you said, within the West now, that Russia, as currently governed, is a problem, is a challenge. And that something has to be done about it. And, you know, it's not going to be sorted in this summit. It's not going to be sorted just by NATO. But I do think this is historic in terms of it's marking the beginning of that process.
On that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today, unfortunately. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been Mark Galeotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Thanks, Mark, for an enlightening discussion, as always.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
And I would also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Bruce Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. The Power Vertical podcast will take a couple of weeks off as I will be on the road traveling, but join us again in 3 weeks. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.